Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're talking to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. On March 16th, Oscar-winning actor George Clooney and his father, journalist Nick Clooney, Martin Luther King III, comedian Dick Gregory, and several members of Congress were arrested along with other activists protesting on the grounds of the Sudanese embassy to the United States in Washington. Clooney and the others were trying to raise awareness of President Omar al-Bashir's continuing use of starvation as a weapon of war, blocking transportation of food and other humanitarian aid to the South. Johnson Ring knows about these and other agonies. He is one of the lost boys of Sudan, orphaned in the country's second civil war. A former graduate teaching assistant at MTSU, he graduated in May 2011 with a master's degree in professional science with a concentration in biostatistics. He earned his bachelor's in neuroscience at the University of Texas at Dallas in 2008. We'll speak with Johnson Ring about his amazing life's journey and his plans for the future after this from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. Elected officials, business operators, and citizens agree it's difficult to create new jobs in Tennessee and everywhere else in America. Some suggested at a congressional field hearing June 18th at MTSU that scrapping more than 3 years' worth of new federal regulations, including the Dodd-Frank Act, Affordable Care Act, and Environmental Protection Agency changes, is the answer. Conducted by the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, the hearing, titled Tennessee Job Creation, Do Federal Government Regulations Help or Hinder Tennessee's Economic Development?, drew more than 150 spectators, most of them business-suited, to the State Farm Room inside the Business and Aerospace Building here on the MTSU campus. For MTSU News anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Johnson Ring, welcome to MTSU on the Record.
Nice to be on your record with you, Jenna.
Tell us where you were born and a little something about your family.
I was born in Bortown, Dongle State, South Sudan. Mm-hmm. I believe it was on February 25th, 1981.
Why do you think your birthday is February 23rd?
During the process of coming to America, we were asked when we were born, but because I lost my parents during the war. The war started in 1983, and we were living in Bortown. Mm-hmm. My father was working for missionaries as a guard, of like a security officer. Mm-hmm. So when the war broke out on May 16, 1983, we had to evacuate, go to the village, so for protection from Sudan Army. And during that process, my dad remained in Bortown, because the Sudan Army had surrounded the town and wouldn't allow him to go to the village where we were. It was four of us, two sisters, one brother, and myself, and our mom. And then roughly in 1985, my father managed to escape and came back home in the village and rejoined with us. And my mother had a waterborne disease called bilharzia. Mm. So she decided to go to the other side of River Nile. We live on the eastern bank of River Nile. So she decided to cross to the western side of River Nile to seek medical treatment, traditional medical treatment. When she went there, she died in 85. Mm-hmm. And so from there, the war had intensified, and in 87, we had to flee. The villages or South Sudan, and we sought refuge in Ethiopia, first country that we went to. So because I lost my parents, I didn't know when I was born exactly, right? Because we didn't have records. If they did, I don't know. I don't remember. So when the process started, I didn't want to be given the birthday of 1-1.
A lot of people are.
I knew the year, but I didn't know the exact date. So I said it has to be February 25th.
How did you get to Ethiopia?
We trekked. We walked on foot from South Sudan to Ethiopia. It took us, I think, roughly 30 days. I don't remember. I was only 6 years by then. I had to be taken care of by some of the older boys from my village. And we walked until we came to a local town called Penyindu in Ethiopia. It had only one building with a corrugated iron roof that was rusted. Mm-hmm. And that is where we were resettled. And after some months, the United Nations started bringing in food.
And this was a refugee camp?
Yeah, it was a refugee camp called Penyindu Refugee Camp.
And did you live most of your childhood years, growing up years, in the refugee camp?
Yeah. I lived in a refugee camp for roughly 14 years. From 87, I was six when I left, so 87 to part of 1991, before the Ethiopian government was overthrown, we lived in Penyindu refugee camp. And then the Ethiopian government under the leadership of Mengistu El Mariam was overthrown. So we had to run, coming back to Sudan through the south. We came to a border town between South and Ethiopia, South Sudan and Ethiopia, called Pochala. We stayed there for, I think, maybe 7 months. And then the Sudan government sent the army there to go and destroy us. But thank God, before they got there, the message had leaked to the SPLM, the rebel government, SPLM, SPLA, that the Sudan army was coming there to kill us and capture the town. So we were evacuated. We started moving along the forests and desert areas of South Sudan, coming toward Kenya. Then we came to another town close to the border of South Sudan and Kenya called Nairuz. And in Nairuz, a few days later, the Sudan government captured a nearby town called Kapoita. And they were only some few kilometers away from us. So the government of SPLM, SPLA also ordered us to be sent to Kenya, like the border within Kenya, just across from the border with South Sudan. So we had to walk there up to Lokichokio, right, on the border of South Sudan and Kenya. There, I think there was a fear that the Sudan government could still come there and bomb the camp or send the troop and destroy the camp.
Or the Janjaweed.
Janjaweed were not in that part.
Not in that part?
Yeah.
No. The Janjaweed, for those who don't know, is this group of Sudanese who work, they're not official members of the army, but they work in cahoots with the Bashir government and wreak havoc. They rape, they kill, they're paramilitary people, if
yes,
you will.
Uh-huh.
And we'll have more on this in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state, with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Johnson Ring, who is an MTSU graduate from Sudan, about his life there during the terror wreaked by Omar al-Bashir, which continues to this day, even though South Sudan has obtained its independence. You were talking about at which point in the journey you had gotten to Kenya, I believe.
Lokichokio.
Oshoke.
On the border of Kenya and South Sudan.
Okay.
And that was in 1992. I believe it was around June, if not July.
Mm-hmm.
So the United Nations had to evacuate us from that camp to take us deep into Kenya. So we moved from Lokichokio to Kakuma refugee camp, where we lived for 9 years before we came to the U.S.
What was your family's health like throughout this years-long migration from place to place?
Yeah, when we fled the country, when we fled South Sudan, it was only a group of young boys. We were not together with our parents because the Sudan government was only interested in killing the boys because they believed we would become the future army for the South. Those of us who were grown enough to be able to hold the gun and fire it were taken to the army.
Yeah.
There could have been some kids who felt that they wanted to liberate their country, so they voluntarily joined the army.
Right.
But there was not coercion or force to join the army.
There was no conscription.
So on the part of health, we lost a lot of our brothers and friends on the way. Some of them drowned in some of the tributaries of River Nile. Some of them were eaten by wild animals like hyenas, lions, and so on. Some of them were eaten by crocodiles. And in Penyindu refugee camp, we had a lot of sicknesses because there were no medications and there was shortage of food. So some of us died of hunger and some died because of diseases. And on the way, we lost a significant number because when we left, roughly we were 30,000 boys. When we came back to Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, we were only 16,000. So 14,000 had gone, maybe into the army or left the world.
Sudanese students here at MTSU have told me stories about how the women in the refugee camps were afraid to go to the well to get water because every time a woman would do that, they would be attacked by the Janjaweed and raped, and that risking being raped by the Janjaweed or a member of the Bashir government army was a real palpable terror. Did you fear for any of your female relatives while you were in these camps?
Yeah, our camps were different from other camps because there were some camps closer to the to North Sudan where the government troops could go there and do those kind of activities. On the other hand, our camps were in neighboring countries. So the fear would have been from local native people. And after some time, after some years in the camp, in 1994, the United Nations, under like the branch of UNHCR, they decided to construct some barbed wire centers where people would go to receive their ration, the food that they distributed. So women were forced to leave home at night, maybe 3 a.m., to go and line up in the line because the queue was too long. And in that case, some of the criminals and maybe, I don't know, a lot of criminals, be them refugees or native, would go there and do whatever they wanted to do. So there was some existence of such kind of crimes, but there was no alternative for women because they had to go and collect the food for their kids.
Did any other non-governmental organizations, any other charity organizations, make it into the refugee camps where you were other than the United Nations? Did you ever see the Red Cross, the Red Crescent, Doctors Without Borders, anybody?
A lot of branches, I would call them branches of UN, were there because the services, camp services were broken down into categories. One was the food supply. That was handled by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR. First, medical care or medical services were rendered by, I think, IRC, International Rescue Committee. Lutheran World Federation was also there. And I think it took over before, later on and started providing food, and maybe it also took over education. So we had other non-governmental agencies like Red Abundant. We took care of us when we were in Ethiopia. And I didn't see Doctors Without Borders.
did you live in a constant state of fear, or was it a situation where you had known hardly anything else but, since you were very little, this was what life was like, and so while you knew it wasn't the best kind of life or the right kind of life, you knew it as life, and you weren't terrified 100% of the time?
Yeah, I think what had happened was that we became adapted to that kind of life, and we didn't feel any fear. We knew that we were living in fear, but to us, that was just like a normal life to us, because if you had never had a better life, you think the life that you have is the better life. Mm-hmm. Before we came to America, maybe in a refugee camp after we finished high school, we thought we were better off. But when we came to America, we found out that what we had was nothing compared to a normal human life.
Were you able to keep up with any of the politics, by which I mean, did John Garang and Salva Kiir, two of the leaders of the resistance, did they give you any hope that there would be a better day for Sudan someday?
Yes. They call us, in Arabic, they call us Terab. In English, that means the seed or future leaders for South Sudan. And especially John Garang spearheaded this program of now called the Lost Boys. And it was the SPLA goal that we become educated so that when the country is liberated, we can go and fight the war of illiteracy and poverty.
John Garang unfortunately died in a helicopter crash, I believe, and Salva Kiir, who was his number two man, more or less took over the movement from that point forward. How did you feel when it was officially reported that South Sudan had been acknowledged as its own nation, as its own country?
It was a shocking news, because we had never envisioned it happening during our lifetime. But when it happened, we knew through the blood of our heroes, we knew that one time, we were going to gain our independence. And what gave us hope during the struggle was the verse from the Old Testament, Isaiah 18. In Isaiah 18, they talk about tall, skinny, smooth body people, that whose country is intertwined by rivers. Mm-hmm. And if you go deep into the Bible, that is South Sudan. Also, it's mentioned that after a long struggle, these people will take their flag and will host it on Mount Zion. So we knew that one day we will be free, but we didn't know when.
Well, we'll pause for another moment, and we'll be back with more on MTSU on the Record right after this.
Expanding Your Horizons is an annual hands-on science and math conference for middle and high school girls. EYH enables girls to investigate careers in science and math and to talk with female leaders in those fields that are so essential to our nation's future. EYH also provides the girls with fun hands-on activities and allows them to meet girls with similar interests. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, EYH Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with MTSU alumnus Johnson Ring, one of the lost boys of Sudan, lost no more. Why does it take a celebrity protest to get America to pay attention to Sudan?
That is a hard question. I would first like to begin by saying that American government hands are tied behind by the economy. So when it comes to security issues like what is going on in Sudan and what is going on in Syria, and also given the power from other world superpowers like China and Russia, it's hard for America by itself to do something unilaterally. Mm-hmm. So it's in the interest, in the best interest of American government to do something to help the Nubian people, to help the Blue Nile people, to help all the people, that the marginalized people of Sudan in general. But what is the best way to do it? The government has tried, American government has tried by imposing sanctions. These sanctions, they haven't helped at all, because Bashir came into power by a military coup. He is using religious doctrines to govern the country. And what they do is this idea that the other people are invading our religion, which is not true.
Right.
There are other Muslims, like in Darfur, in Blue Nile, in Nuba Mountain, that they are killing now.
Bashir pits Muslims against black tribal Africans, when in fact the black tribal Africans are not a threat to the Muslims. He's using propaganda to foment this attitude.
To hold on to power.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that he can remain in power is by inciting people against each other by using religious doctrines and ideologies. Now, what is the best way for America to help Sudanese people that are suffering? Mm-hmm. I would suggest, in my own personal opinion, that one, we would impose a no-fly zone over Blue Nile, Nuba Mountain, even East Sudan and Darfur. We would, when I say we would, I mean American government,
right?
Because I'm an American citizen. So we would also arm the SPLM North, because Sudan army is superior than them, and they cannot do it if they go head to head. So if we arm them, give them anti-aircraft weapons, and give them the anti-tank weapons, they will be able to liberate themselves like we saw in Libya.
When did you become a naturalized American citizen?
That was in 2007 in Dallas, Texas.
Why do you like science? Why do you like biostatistics?
I had always enjoyed working with science and mathematics. When I was in high school, my best subjects were physics, chemistry, biology, and mathematics. I was also good in the other social sciences, but I didn't like them that much. The reason being, in Africa, especially in South Sudan, your relatives' parents would only value education in engineering, medical, or law, or geology.
Those are the disciplines that
those
are important to your parents.
They have higher prestige.
Yeah.
So when I came here, my goal was to go to medical school or pharmacy school. But after graduating, I decided against it because I found out that I was not well suited for that kind of work, rigorous studying. Mm-hmm. But while I was going to Richland College, when I took Statistics 1, Applied Statistics, I said to myself, why don't I become a statistician, so that I can make decisions. So my reason of liking statistics is to be able to make decisions using information that I have collected from a given source of data.
We'll pause one more time and we'll return with more with Johnson Ring on MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking to Johnson Ring, who graduated from MTSU in May 2011 with a master's degree in professional science and a concentration in biostatistics.
Now I teach in the math department here at MTSU. I would like to go back to school for a PhD. So maybe, God willing, in August, I might start my doctoral studies. I have applied to a few schools or universities. The reason I want to do a PhD is In South Sudan, we have a lot of diseases that can be easily eradicated. My primary goal is to do research in STDs, STIs, HIV, AIDS.
AIDS is a massive problem in Africa.
Yeah. My state of Jonglei in South Sudan has a rampant spread of syphilis, and syphilis can be easily eradicated. So my goal is if I manage to get a PhD, then I would collaborate with some of my colleagues, American colleagues, and maybe with South Sudan government so that we can determine why is it that this syphilis is so rampant in South Sudan? Why is it that HIV/AIDS is so rampant in South Sudan? What can we do? Using data analysis, I think we can help the government to reduce the spread.
Tell me what your educational experience here at MTSU was like for you.
I was able to interact with a lot of outstanding faculty members, Dr. Green, Lisa Green, for example, Dr. Frodesen of the coordinator of the director of MSPS.
Dr. Saeed Farudistan, he's also the Associate Dean of the College of Basic and Applied Sciences.
Yeah. And a lot of other professors that helped me during my graduate studies. Now, a lot of my student friends are coming to me even with advanced statistics courses for help, and I am able to help them. So I think now after finishing or graduating from MTSU, I realize my potential that I'm only good or I'm the best in statistics. And also I have never visited my country in 25 years. My sister, I have never seen her in 25 years.
That's how long you've been away from South Sudan.
Yeah, so I would like to be able to go back there and see her.
And meet your nieces and nephews.
Yeah, so to go there, it costs a lot of money. So I need to work so that I can save a little that will buy a ticket and maybe buy some few clothes for my nephews and nieces.
Well, Johnson, it's been a pleasure meeting you, and I wish you all the best of luck in all of your future endeavors, academic, professional, and otherwise. You're only the latest in a long line of terrific Sudanese students I've met while I've been working here at MTSU. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. I'm also privileged to be your guest today, and I would like to extend my gratitude to Karen Case and Steve Case for the connection and for the help that they are rendering me while I'm here now.
Karen works for the College of Basic and Applied Sciences, and Steve is her husband. The privilege is mine. Thank you.
Thank you, too.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.